Hey, this is Chuck Dixon, and you're listening to Signal of Doom.
Well, you know, for me, the action is the juice. I'm in.
Is everybody in? Is everybody in? Everybody in. The ceremony is about to begin.
Hello and welcome to Signal of Doom, episode 131. I'm Dave. It's a solo show. It's Warren Zevon entering the studios in the 70s for his debut solo album, Warren Zevon, one of my all-time favourites. Now, big news this week. We're doing Grimjack. I'm kind of covering the first half of the first omnibus. That was a huge read. Very enjoyable. So that's the trade of the week. Personal news, I'm very happy to announce that I proposed to Michelle yesterday and she accepted. She said yes, so Michelle and I will be getting married and that will take place, I would assume, sometime next year. But yeah, so it just happened yesterday, so that was big news for Michelle and myself. So I thought I'd share it with our listeners, many of whom have already reached out, seen on social media. So thank you to everybody. It is much appreciated, your best wishes. And we've been together 11 and a half years. So I think I'd given it a fair run before making my mind up, or at least popping the question. So there's that. As I said, Grimjack's the trade of the week. Stu's still away on jury duty. Ray will be coming on next episode. We're just deciding what exactly it was we're going to do, but I think it's going to be some Walking Dead. So let's just kick off into the news. It's been a hectic news week, and Signal is Lois. I'm here with my pen and paper and my iPhone and my laptop, and Lois is just reporting on the news this week. It's been a busy news week. First off, the Joker movie wins the Golden Lion at Venice Film Festival. We had last week that there was a standing ovation of 8 minutes. Got to be honest, I'd start to get a little tired if I was in that crowd after, you know, about the 2 minute mark. I mean, maybe even the 1 minute mark for me. I don't generally clap at like films. I've been in cinemas where they do clap. I find it always a fairly awkward experience personally, unless the directors are on hand or something. But anyway, it won the Golden Lion, which is, you know, good signs. Obviously, they're thinking about it being an awards contender, and I'm eager for it, basically. Reporter plot details for the Matt Reeves-directed The Batman reveal a detective-driven story that finds super sleuth Bruce Wayne digging into a conspiracy that involves Batman's already established rogues gallery. The Batman will explore a detective case. When people start dying in strange ways, Batman must go deep into the dark world of Gotham to find clues and solve the mystery conspiracy connected to Gotham's history and criminals, claims scooper Daniel Richman. In the film, all of Batman's rogues gallery are already out there and active, similar to the comics and animated shows movies. The film will have multiple villains as they are all suspects, which is, I mean, I know that's not technically the Hush storyline, but that's definitely the device that Hush uses to have Batman interacting with multiple level of villains through the storyline. And it works very well there, and I think they did a lot with Hush. Anyway, I'm excited for it. I guess we're all familiar with like a lot of these villains from previous iterations of the movies, let alone the comics. It could work. I mean, Robert Pattinson, I think we're all starting to get our heads around it now and feel that he could potentially be a very good Batman. I mean, there's nothing to say that he can't turn it up. We had this news. Green Lantern Corps movie is rumoured for HBO Max. So, yeah, this is interesting. This only came across my desk today. I got given some news, actually, by Adam the Computer. I reached out to me with news on this. Let's examine the news item because I haven't had a chance to really examine it. And when I say examine, we basically mean read off a news item. So it was Cosmic Book News. According to TVO, from the Lords of the Long Box YouTube channel, Greg Berlanti is developing the Green Lantern series, Green Lantern Core series, which will feature Kyle Rayner, so the 90s Green Lantern. It said the reason Green Lantern Core will be on HBO Max is that HBO Max will be able to give the show, the series, the best budget. They didn't want to put it on the CW because the CW would not be able to do it justice. The official announcement about HBO Max saw Berlanti is confirmed to creating original movies and content for the streaming service. Well, okay. I'm open to it, and I mean, look, obviously, they're going to go down. You think there's going to be a Green Lantern movie at some stage? Is there already one announced? I'm not sure, but it's about time they announced one. And I think, you know, Hal Jordan could be used there. Whereas for the Green Lantern Corps, yeah, Kyle Rayner sounds good to me. Now here I've got a big news dump on The Stand. The Stand is the Stephen King novel, considered by many to be his best novel, about a worldwide plague. Now, we've got a lot of update of news on this coming from CBS's All Access series adaptation of Stephen King's The Stand. Alexander Skarsgård is set to play the villain Randall Flagg. In addition, Whoopi Goldberg has completed negotiations and officially joined the cast as Mother Abigail. James Marsden will play Stu Redman, a Texan man who is the first man to be discovered to be immune to the Captain Trips virus that has ravaged the planet. He eventually becomes a leader in the community known as the Free Zone and is tasked with confronting the evil Randall Flagg, who is kind of like almost like a satanic character, really. Amber Heard, she's a hot little number, is Nadine Cross, a private school teacher and a virgin who believes she has a unique destiny by Flagg's side. Oh, she's a baddie. Goldberg is Mother Abigail, who is immune to the super flu and leads the good survivors of the plague towards Boulder, Colorado. She also claims to be a prophet of God. Oscar nominee Greg Kinnear, his career's quieting down, is Glenn Bateman, an arthritis afflicted professor who joins Stu on his journey to meet Mother Abigail. Odessa Young is Franny Goldsmith, a pregnant woman who leaves her devastated community with a man named Harold Lauder, but ends up falling in love with Stu. Henry Zagger is Nick Andros, a young deaf-mute grifter. Johnny Jovan Adipo is Larry Underwood, a young musician with a taste for fame and illegal substances. Brad William Henk is Tom Cullen, Andros's travelling companion and a sweet but developmentally challenged man. Daniel Sanjuta is Cobb, a military man charged with supervising Stu. So there's a lot going on there. The project hails from writers Josh Boone and Ben Cavill, with Boone to set to direct. Stephen King wrote the 10th and final episode of the series, so it's going to be a 10-episode series on CBS All Access, which will feature a new coda to the story that wasn't part of the author's novel. I'm actually reading The Stand at the moment, or listening to it on audiobook, and yeah, I think a lot of people say it's the best Stephen King novel out there. And I'm particularly excited for it. I think it's I remember in the 90s, this is funny actually, I might have mentioned this on the show before, but there was about a 1990, basically Rob Lowe was in it, and it was a TV adaptation, like telemovie. I think it was like a two-parter. It was pretty big. It was on multiple videotapes, and I'm watching it one day with two mates of mine at the time, and my mate of mine was big into the army and stuff. When we're watching, I was pretty stoned, and I remember he turned around and said, in the middle of like this full-on global apocalypse with this plague, he turned around and said, "These are the days I dream of." And I was like, "Shit, man." He goes, "Yeah." He said, this is how I want it to go down. And I was like, "Jesus, man." Like that, I mean, even at the time, I was like, "That's deep." And post-apocalypse. I mean, people say, "I enjoy it." Well, this was a guy who wanted it. He was ready for it too. He was a stockpiler. He had weaponry. I mean, he viewed things through that lens from that early age. We were both about 18 at the time. Anyway, moving on from that. So I'm looking forward to that Stephen King series. X-Men animated series and the Spider-Man animated series will be at Disney Plus at launch. So when it launches in November, both the X-Men 90s animated series and the Spider-Man 90s animated series will be on Disney Plus. Taika Waititi is in talks to appear at Suicide Squad sequel. I've heard now that that's locked. I've heard that I saw an image today of all the people who are going to be in it, which included Taika Waititi and Nathan Fillion, amongst many others. Hawkeye's Disney Plus series eyes Hayley Steinfeld for a lead role, playing Kate Bishop, actually. So that could be very interesting. Then we had this piece of news. Now, tell me what you think of this. It's a comic we're doing this week, Age of Resistance. Snoke takes Kylo Ren to Dagobah, the Jedi, well, not the Jedi planet, but a planet that's very strong in the Force. And in that, basically, Kylo goes into the same cave that Luke Skywalker went into in Empire Strikes Back. And as we know, in Empire Strikes Back, he faced the dark side of, I kind of guess, of his, like, consciousness or something, and was Darth Vader, was what he feared the most, and he fought Darth Vader in a scene that confused the hell out of me as a kid. I was like, shit, Darth Vader's at Dagobah, and then the he chops his head off, and I was like, what the fuck's going on? And they're like, it's symbolic, and I was like, what's symbolic mean? I was a confused kid when that originally happened in cinemas. I was young as well, so I didn't fully grasp what was happening. And I've never really liked it. The Dagobah scene of Empire Strikes Back is easily the most boring scene for me. I know that's probably heresy. I know that it establishes Yoda. I know it serves a purpose. But me personally, in a movie that I absolutely love, Empire Strikes Back, the Dagobah scene is always a bit where I sort of like, time for me to get a cup of tea. I just think in that movie, the Hoth battle and the Cloud City action is just so exciting, and the stuff with the Millennium Falcon, I always felt that scene on Dagobah was my least favorite. Well, in this, Snoke takes Kylo Ren to the cave and he faces what he fears the most, which is Luke. So, you know, it mirrors it. You could say perfectly, but or you could say extremely obviously. Anyway, there's that. Now, Paramount is remaking Face Off, the 90s classic with John Travolta and Nick Cage. I can't see them. This feels like the remake of Point Break all over again. Like, you can't beat the original. You simply can't. There's no way in hell they'll do as good a job as John Woo did with Travolta and Nick Cage. Like, I'm sorry. And, like, it was the same with Point Break. Like, you mirrored the story. You tried to mirror the beats. You didn't even get close. And so now they're going back and remaking Face Off. And I won't support it in cinemas. I'd rather watch the original Face Off. If you said to me right now, someone had the DVD or on streaming, let's watch Face Off, I'd be like, yeah, I'll watch it. The original, thanks. The Dungeons & Dragons Rick and Morty adventure is appearing on Amazon. This was interesting, like basically a module. We did the comic recently of Rick and Morty versus Dungeons and Dragons, and I thought it was excellent. I remember really enjoying that. That was a really good read, and I anticipate this will be equally good. Margot Robbie is apparently planning a new Tank Girl adaptation. This is from her Happy Chap production company has apparently optioned the rights. So will Margot Robbie be playing Tank Girl? We don't know. This was a huge 90s property. Or when I say huge, a big cult 90s property. Laurie Petty, I remember doing the film in a very 90s influenced way, and it was a cool character that like existed on sort of the cult end side of the comics book market in the 90s. And, I mean, one of the creators of Tank Girl, is his name Jamie Howlett or James Howlett? I believe he went on to do the animation for the Gorillaz band with Damon Albarn, which was I always liked Gorillaz. And, yeah, he did all the animation and stuff for that, kind of the multimedia segment of it. So, yeah, I mean, talented team that put that together. And, I mean, Margot Robbie, there was talk there was going to be a new Birds of Prey, but unfortunately I'm doing the show a bit later today and it still hasn't appeared, the new Birds of Prey trailer, so we'll have to keep our eyes out for that. I would potentially go and watch a new Tank Girl adaptation. I don't know a lot about Tank Girl, but what I saw in the 90s I enjoyed. I thought it was a cool counterculture kind of counter-programming to the sort of mainstream stuff. Okay, now we've got some news here that came from We Got This Covered. We Got This Covered has been informed by the same sources that told them Viola Davis returning for Suicide Squad and that Black Adam will be returned for Shazam 3, both of which have since been confirmed, that Warner Brothers really wants Keanu Reeves in the DCEU and are considering bringing him back as the Hellblazer, so John Constantine. As we've previously reported, this is We Got This Covered, he's also linked to a rebooted Deathstroke, while he could also end up in Ava DuVernay's New Gods as well. Clearly, the studio hasn't figured out exactly where they want him just yet, but they're definitely keen to get him involved in DCU. Well, Keanu would be a huge get. I think that there's a lot of characters out there that Keanu would be a good fit for. Something cosmic with the New Gods, I think, is potentially a very good idea. Deathstroke, I thought they had a good Deathstroke. I thought that the guy they actually got to play Deathstroke was a very good choice, and I don't see any reason to recast that. Yes, there's not really any sort of news other than they're trying to lock in Keanu. Now, here was another rumor that actually excited me, and for a moment I thought it was more than a rumor. Liam Neeson is eyed for a Marvel role as Galactus, some outlets are reporting. Now, my only concern, obviously he'd be voicing it, is that famously Orson Welles' last gig was playing Unicron in a Transformers movie. And I believe they put him through a voice filter as well, so Orson Welles' magnificent voice, you couldn't even hear properly. Liam Neeson, always good, would be very interesting, I think. He's got gravitas in his voice, he's a very likable actor. You need someone with that kind of a voice, that kind of Ian McKellen kind of style actor, a Patrick Stewart, someone who's, you know, comes from a theatrical background almost, playing Galactus. I don't want Galactus to be a fucking cloud like he was in Fantastic Four. I want Galactus to be the real fucking deal. We saw the Celestials have been used at times in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and some of the more interesting segments, I think, when they expound on that. So Galactus is, I know he's not a Celestial, I'm not even sure what he is really, but he's certainly from that kind of power set. DC are developing a Batman Death in the Family animated movie. I thought they'd already done this under the Red Hood, but I guess to do more the story of Death in the Family and the death of the Robin, which just sort of happens at the start of Under the Red Hood in a very dark scene. And Mark Hamill and Kevin Conroy have certainly lobbied for this, but yet someone mentioned neither of them, both of them mentioned Hush, but neither of them ended up playing a voice role in Hush. So I definitely hope the DC animation get clearance and use Kevin Conroy, who's so good, and use Mark Hamill, who's so good in Batman Death in the Family. I believe it's a waste opportunity when they don't use them. For example, Dark Knight Returns is excellent, but I think it would have been even better with Kevin Conroy doing the voice. Mysterio actor Jake Gyllenhaal has played Coy in a recent interview when asked about the possibility of his character, Mysterio, returning as a Sinister Six member in a future Spider-Man film. "I can't answer your question," he said. Obviously, this is a very delicate time for Sony and Marvel. I'm getting more and more excited by the idea of using Spider-Man in a ton of Sony Spider-Verse properties. I just feel it's quite possible. I mean, Sony did the first two Spider-Man movies so well, the originals. Say what you like about Tobey Maguire, but those two movies hit. And like they did Spider-Verse, Spider-Man's got a ton. There's a ton of gifted creators out there. If you get the right creators on the project, the right creatives, then anything's possible. And like Sinister Six, yeah, it's all Spider-Man villains, so it can be done. Hayden Christensen and Ian McDermott, however you say his name, but he's the guy who plays the Emperor, cancelled a con appearance after apparently a legal warning from Disney. Disney apparently is very, very, very adverse to leaking anything to do with Episode 9, and they fear that Hayden Christensen, together with this guy, the Emperor, who was teased in the Rise of Skywalker trailer, could potentially spoil some of the movie. And they threatened the con with legal cease and desist threats unless they pulled the appearance, which they did. Watch this space. I mean, at most, I think you'll see Hayden Christensen appear as a Force ghost. And I don't think he'll be evil. I don't think that it will be the dark side of the Force. But I could be wrong. I think it could be very interesting. I certainly wasn't a fan of Hayden Christensen back in the day, but I do think that he could be used for a scene quite effectively. There were huge problems at times with the prequels and the acting and stuff, but it was the direction as well. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, look, I'm definitely open to an appearance from him. I'm curious to see what happens with the Emperor. Like, sure, they've got a lot to wrap up in that movie. Disney is rumored to be developing a live-action Robin Hood remake using anthropomorphic creatures such as they used in Jungle Book. I mean, the classic Robin the Hood, where Robin's the fox, that animated was an absolute classic for many years. I mean, I remember a lot of people watching that and really enjoying that. So it would be really interesting for like a really good high-budget Robin Hood remake. I think it could be better than any of the Robin Hood remakes since Prince of Thieves. I think Robin Hood as a property is fantastic, but I think that gives a different flavor. It's more kid-orientated. I'd watch it in a heartbeat. Robin Hood's one of my favorite characters. And I remember having the kind of like, I don't know if they were golden books, but they were sort of like the books that had images from those Disney movie and other Disney animated movies from like the 60s and 70s. So yeah, I'd be 100% down for that. Stan Lee will be honored with his own street in the Bronx on July 23, the New York City Council approved a proposal to add Stanley Way as a co-name for a portion of University Avenue. The new name would highlight the streets between Bront Place and the West 176th Street in the Bronx. So, cool. Stan's going to, you know, live on in a street name. I mean, that's fantastic. Then we had, interestingly here, Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3 news. I'm so pissed that Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3 is only on the Nintendo Switch. But apparently more playable heroes are coming in 3 DLC packs, the first of which will arrive this fall, contain Moon Knight, Blade, Punisher, and Morbius. Future packs will include the Fantastic Four and X-Men. So thank Christ that Marvel are now bringing it all under one banner, and all those characters like your Punishers, your Blades, you know, your Marvel Knights characters, Moon Knight included, are going to be included in the game, and also the Fantastic Four and X-Men. Who obviously were part of Fox, owned by Fox, and weren't being pumped in the gaming side of things, and now getting included as well. So that's fantastic news. Tom Taylor and Bruno Redondo relaunched Suicide Squad in December. That's confirmed news. So in December, Suicide Squad will relaunch. I will be reading from the beginning. Tom Taylor has never really let me down. He always provides an entertaining comic book. Sometimes I think really reaches for the sky and achieves. Rob Liefeld was very vocal on Twitter. I almost didn't put this in because it was so meaningless. Basically just him sounding off about how much DC sucks. Now, I mean, we've all seen creators who are kind of angry at DC, fair enough, but it wasn't just DC sucks. He was like really, really hyping his own ability, like to a ridiculous level, like almost like he was number one. And I'm like, Rob, you've been very successful, but I don't think you're an all-time number one guy. I don't know. It was just, it's poor form, really. It was just him kind of trolling DC, to be honest. It wasn't even that funny. It was just kind of more like, it came across just more as like a heavy ego trip, which, you know, I don't know. It doesn't really excite me. We had a really interesting article here, which I want to dive into. Robert E. Howard article on Bleeding Cool. Marvel are creating new runs of comic book characters based on how Robert E. Howard's characters, Dart Agnes, Solomon Kane, and more. Obviously, he was the creator of Conan, which Marvel bought the rights to, but they also bought the rights to these other characters. In fact, it sounds like they bought the rights to all his characters outside of Red Sonja. Big news, it's revealed that Moon Knight is being reintroduced through a Conan story and in his world. Jim Zub, the man who grabbed Conan in the Avengers and ran with him, will be writing a new Marvel Universe / Conan crossover series using a few of Robert E. Howard's other creations. It's called Serpent War. Serpent War is a sprawling cross-dimensional epic bringing together legendary characters from the mind of Robert E. Howard with a bit of Marvel mayhem added in for good measure. This is Jim Zub talking. The story I told him in Savage Sword was a straightforward sword and sorcery tale. This one is big, ambitious, and adventurous on a bigger stage. I hope Serpent War engages long-time Conan fans and also brings in new readers on board to see what all the excitement's about. Moon Knight is our big Marvel wild card in all of this, and I'm incredibly happy with how Mark Spector is woven into the big bits of the story and how Khonshu and the power of the moon factor into some of our biggest action scenes. When we were looking at which Marvel characters could be involved in the story we'd eventually call Serpent War and what their involvement would bring to the mix, Mark Basio introduced the idea of using Moon Knight and instantly knew he'd be a great choice. Khonshu and Set, the Egyptian god, have been at odds many times in the past, and Moon Knight's troubled history gave us lots of interesting things to explore. Playing Moon Knight off Solomon Kane is my favorite thing right now. It's a Puritan with unwavering faith, Solomon Cain, set against an unhinged heathen. So Solomon Cain has never interacted with his God, whereas obviously Moon Knight speaks directly to his diary, yet doubts everything about himself and his place in the world. It's a study in contrast, and they both bring cool things out of each other. So let's just kind of like dive a bit deeper. Solomon Cain is a late 16th to early 17th century Puritan who wanders the world with no apparent goal other than to vanquish evil in all its forms. His adventures, published mostly in the pop magazine Weird Tales, often take him from Europe to the jungles of Africa and back. A tall, somber and gloomy man of pale skin, gaunt face and cold eyes, all of it shadowed by a slouch hat. He is dressed entirely in black, and his weaponry usually consists of a rapier, a dirk and a brace of flintlock pistols. During one of his later adventures, his friend Nolonga, an African shaman, gave him a juju staff that could be served as a protection of evil, could easily be wielded as a weapon. It is revealed in another story, The Footfalls Within, that this is the mythical staff of Solomon, a talisman older than the earth and unimaginably powerful, much more so than Nolonga knew. Meanwhile, Dark Agnes de Chastelain was the protagonist of three stories set in 16th century France, which were not printed until long after the author's death, Robert E. Howard's death. The character of Agnes was beaten by her father and almost forced into an arranged marriage. She avoids this by killing the bridegroom and running away. She meets Ethan Villers, who at first attempts to sell her to a brothel, and Guillard de Cossin, a mercenary captain who trains her as a swordsman. When de Cossin is killed, Agnes heads for Italy with Villiers. So, like the other, like the later character Red Sonja, who is based on another Howard character, Red Sonja, also, Agnes has red hair and a short temper. While Red Sonja's skill in the handling of swords is a divine gift, Agnes's skill is a mixture of innate talent and training. So, look, Marvel published several comic books featuring Solomon Cain in the 70s and 80s. As with Conan, Dark Horse got the rights to publish the Solomon Cain comic series, and now Marvel Comics has returned. And maybe Dark Agnes might make a replacement for Red Sonja, as Dynamite Entertainment are currently telling her adventures. So that's a lot of information, guys. Let's kind of unpack it for a second. As a Robert E. Howard fan, not just a Conan fan, but as a Robert E. Howard fan who adores so many of his stories and has read quite a lot of his stories outside of just Conan, he was a gifted storyteller with a real knack for pulsating plot, pulp plots with cool characters as the central, you know, character. Solomon Cain, I've never read, actually. I have all of Cull, and I'm surprised Cull the Conqueror is not getting a run here if we're doing Solomon Cain and some of that, because Cull is a pretty cool character. A sort of more, how would you say, philosophical version of Conan, the King of Atlantis. I've read several of his storylines. I've not read any Solomon Cain, but I believe I might actually have the book somewhere on my shelf. I really should hunt it down. I have them all digitally as well. You can get them all digitally. I've not heard of Dark Agnes. I've never read those ones, but I may potentially have some of the stories digitally because I bought quite a lot of Robert E. Howard's stuff. He was very gifted. Died tragically too young by his own hand. When his mother died, he got very depressed, I believe. But he was an incredible writer and cast a huge shadow over modern culture. And fantasy owes him a huge debt. And I'm so pleased, though, that Conan broke through to the level he has, which has kind of kept his name up there alongside these other characters. I'm excited for how Marvel have treated the Conan property. I think Marvel have done a really, like, I think it's still early days, but I think they're being very aggressive and confident with a great property, and I think that that's meaning that we're getting, like, quality reprints, and they're being ambitious by bringing in Jim Zub, a guy who we sometimes tease on the show, but actually I find most of the time provides 7 to 7.5 out of 10 comic books. I've never seen him exceed it, but he certainly has many times come in at that 7 to 7.5 out of 10 level, more often than he's dropped, frankly. He's pretty consistent at that level, which is a sign of a, you know, I would say, I would almost put him in a very good writer status. So I think he handled Conan well in that Savage Sword storyline, and I think this sounds like it's an even much more ambitious project. I think bringing in bringing in Khonshu and Moon Knight is a really good idea and a really good usage. I think we'll definitely get Rey on and talk with him, because I think that's going to be essential to get the perspective into the Knight sort of guys. Those guys, we know those guys rove deep. Those guys know Moon Knight like the back of their hand. So I saw excitement on the boards from them. Conan's a fucking great character. So, you know, I think the two things combined, like the Elder Gods, I mean, that's the other cool thing about Conan. Like, Robert E. Howard was friends with Lovecraft, and they had quite the correspondence. And, like, seriously, like, he used the Elder Gods kind of depiction at the backdrop of many of his storylines, which, you know, I've used in the Morn series, for example, and can give it so much flavor. Like, the feeling that you scratch the surface and that's there, awesome. So, you know, that's that news. And, like, let's move on, because we could spend forever, but we're going to get to Shopping with Dave. Now, some interesting stuff came out this week. Giant Days novel. Soft cover. I've read probably the first two arcs of the Giant Days comic. It's kind of a coming-of-age university tales kind of storyline. It's really good. Really good comic, and I would actually probably like to go back and read more of it. I was kind of hooked. Yeah, and they're now doing a novel. I think that's a great idea. I think it was a great YA project, you know, that I thought was as good as, like, you know, say, Terry Moore Strangers in Paradise series, like, really just through a different lens. I also then had King Thor 1. I covered this on the show, but I thought this was really, this is kind of the beginning of the final chapter of Jason Aaron's Thor run. We're going to review it on the show, so I'll discuss it more there, but I thought it was worth saying that was coming out, or has just come out this week. I Hate Fairyland, the deluxe edition. This is Scotty Young's project. Huge, huge hype on this. Everyone who I've spoken to has loved it, and I think getting the deluxe edition is always a great idea, so check out and support Scotty Young's I Hate Fairyland. Bloodshot, the definitive edition. I had a great time with Bloodshot. Like, really, honestly, we did with Ray on the show a couple of weeks ago, and I personally found it, like, some of the more exciting stuff. Like, and getting a definitive edition, getting that big hardcover to put on the shelf, like, classic action, kind of a debt to Weapon X kind of style storytelling, which I'm always available for. Yeah, and I've got scenes in the Demon Asante series that, you know, they're not pulled from Weapon X, but it's that kind of a vibe. I used to play the Wolverine Origins game. I don't know if anyone out there, shout out to anyone if you played the Wolverine Origins game on Xbox 360 or PS, would have been 3, give me a shout out and give me a call back if you have got that, ever played through that game. So Bloodshot, the definitive edition. Napoleon Dynamite 1, I saw this is coming out next week. I love the movie. Back in 83, I could have thrown this ball over those mountains. If coach had just put me in the third quarter. I think it might be back in 82. Back in 82, I could throw this ball over the mountains. Great, great movie. Great movie, Napoleon Dynamite. One of my, probably in my top 10 comedies in terms of movies. I think it's one of the best movies I've seen of comedies ever. Just every scene is killer. Like, every line, it's just a killer movie. And there's a comic book coming out, and I'm impressed. Rick and Morty versus Dungeons and Dragons 2, Painscape 1. We did Rick and Morty versus Dungeons and Dragons 1 on the show, and I really dug it. I've only watched a little of Rick and Morty, but what I have watched, I've really enjoyed. I think it's a very, very entertaining show, and obviously I have an affinity for Dungeons and Dragons. But put the two things together, Jim Zub actually was involved, and I believe he's involved in the new version. I think he mentioned it to me on Twitter when I was sort of giving him some praise for Rick and Morty Dungeons and Dragons 1. So, yeah, I think, look, if you're a Rick and Morty fan, you're in safe hands with Jim Zub. He seems to know what he's doing. Weekly Comics. We're going to kick off here with King Thor 1. I gave this a 6.5 out of 10. Not the most intensely thrilling or accessible comic book I've ever read. It's high fantasy drama, but does feel this is an ending, which it is. And it feels like if you were coming into this first time, good luck. This is almost the coda to Jason Aaron's run, basically. This is kind of like post-War of the Realms, which tied a lot of shit together. It's the final telling. It's the final chapter. If you've read the entire run, and then you've read all of the Jane, you know, Foster Thor run, and then you've read War of the Realms, and you get to this, I think at this point, you know, you want to finish your dish, you want to finish it off. But this isn't a place to start. This is a place to get to, like, the last omnibus and read. So it's a 6.5 out of 10 because I didn't find it that thrilling. But there is a fair bit of content in here. It is great high fantasy drama. 6.5 out of 10 is still a good score. Overall, Jason Aaron's run is like an 8.5 to 9 run on Thor, so don't worry too much. I think if you're this invested that you've gotten this far along, and as always, I'm excited by those people who have. Tell me what you think of this one. But it loses, you know, a point or two for the sheer inaccessibility. Whether that's fair or not is a question for the gods, isn't it, really? Gwenpool Strikes Back 2, 7 out of 10. Entertaining, fun, quite silly, but some very cool humour. She brings in Deadpool. I mean, it's just, it's so nutty. It really is such a nutty book, this one. It's more nutty than almost any Deadpool I've ever read. I really found myself liking it more than I expected. It's silly. Like, she goes to the Fantastic Four Baxter building and she's trying to kiss either Sue Storm or Reed for her own purposes, which almost make no sense. But, like, it's nonsensical, but it's funny. And I think, really, that's the point of it. So it's a humor comic. I gave it 7 out of 10. I really quite enjoyed it. I don't know. It's very sort of... It's dense in a silly way. Like, it's dense in that it's playing around so much with breaking the fourth wall and kind of making a mockery of that convention or that trope. And, you know, it's almost a bit risque, maybe not the right word, but it plays a little adult. I really quite enjoyed it. I thought it was quite a good comic, actually. Much like the first one, when I started reading, I thought, oh, not for me, really. But by the end, I was like, that was actually a good read. Then we had Conan the Barbarian number 9, Jason Aaron... It's run here 8.5 out of 10. Really good issue. He's in these caves and he's trapped and he's fighting all past versions of characters that he's battled against, monsters he's battled against. But it turns out that they're really just depictions through this god that's lying under the ground. And it really is a fucking cool comic. Like, it's an excuse to get a lot of, like, his past villains out to get them on the page for Conan to fight again, but really there's a deeper purpose behind it, and it ties into the character he fights at his death, comes through the time and is fighting, you know, the fear of that character comes through his brain, through time itself, and he fights it in these caves and, in fact, defeats it in this version. It was a really interesting issue of Conan. I really like the way Jason Aaron is just dropping us into the middle of stories but tying it towards a bigger storyline. And, as I said, 8.5 out of 10. Star Wars Age of the Resistance, Supreme Leader Snoke, Issue 1. I gave this a 6 out of 10. Competent but very predictable. Was Snoke a Sith? And if he wasn't a Sith, which I'm sure I've heard people say he wasn't a Sith, he has the exact powers of a Sith. So what makes him not a Sith? Is this question answered? It's definitely not answered in the movies. Apparently it get answered in off-panel and a lot, because I hear people in Jedi Collider, you know, Jedi Council all the time saying he's not a Sith. Well, he seems to act a lot like a fucking Sith. He seems to have Force powers. He's making... Kylo Ren just levitate before he drops him down this chasm, and then Kylo manages to stop his descent through use of the Force. What I didn't like about this issue was really just how basically the same it is. It's the same exact scene, Empire Strikes Back, just inverted. And I didn't find that clever. I found that just incredibly predictable and almost just, I don't know, just sort of... A lack of ambition, really, came through in the telling, and it didn't really give us anything that new. I wasn't a huge fan of it. 6 out of 10. Then we had Age of Conan Valeria 2. Inessential fun, but decent fantasy drama. I'm giving it a 6 out of 10. A lot of people would probably score it lower, but I thought that this was a better issue than issue 1. It was a page turner. It feels a little thin. They're going for Valyria very young, whereas I probably prefer how I saw her in some Savage Sword, where she's more of an established swordswoman. Yeah, look, the art's fine. Meredith Finch does a decent job on writing duties. I did enjoy it, frankly. I'd probably be tempted to push my score to a 6.5 out of 10, actually. If I'm giving... I enjoyed it more than I enjoyed the Snoke issue, even though the Snoke issue's probably got more meat to its bones. The Valyria issue had a little bit of charm, and I found myself reading along. It was a pleasant tale, nothing more, nothing less. But yeah, it was entertaining. That's for sure. And I think once again, Marvel are doing great things with the Conan properties, and I really want to get the perspective of like a Jim at King's Comics to find out how these Conan titles are selling, because how are they responding with readers? Because I mean, I'm really enjoying the main title, like Conan the Barbarian with Jason Aaron. It's a strong title. And it's still early days. They're only at issue 9. Like, you know, time's passing, flicking by quite quickly, and they're really being aggressive. Don't forget, they've also got all the archive editions coming out. I've got 2 hardcovers of the Conan the Barbarian 70 series collected already in omnibus form. I've got 1 issue of Savage Sword, and I've got the other one on order. So, you know, it's coming along. That's it for Weekly Comics this week. I know it probably feels like this is a shorter show, but we've had a lot of news. Like, I mean, I'm going to have Ray on next show. We might pick over some of the news again. Stuff that I want to pin out at my attention. I'm really fascinated by this Stan series. I want to watch that with Michelle. Also, I want to mention that Michelle and myself are watching Fear the Walking Dead, and we're at season 4. And let me tell you, this show has radically changed and gotten a lot better in season 4. And a lot of people might say, yeah, but like that took till season 4. Sure, but I enjoyed season 1, and then I felt it went off the rails a bit, and we barely made it through season 3. Season 4 flips Fear the Walking Dead completely, and I am 100% down for this 10-part Stan show. I mean, I'll be watching that as it comes out for sure. Now, this week, Trade of the Week. Grimjack, okay? Now, I basically started from the start. John Ostrander and Tim Truman, are co-creators in this. John Ostrander's the writer, Timothy Truman's the artist. It's brilliant art, okay? I want to give you the storyline in a nutshell. Grimjack is the sort of like working street name for a character called John Gaunt, who is an ex-soldier, like a mercenary. He's now kind of like a bounty hunter, and he lives in this city called Sinnoh-Shore, which is like a nexus of realities. So basically, like, different realities come through and phase into existence with Sinnoh-Shore, which is kind of like the nexus of reality. So you can cross worlds kind of thing, and he lives in the pit. And he's a native of the pit, which is like the slums of Sinnoh-Shore. And he has a bar there, Munden's Bar, which I believe he owns from reading it. And that isn't intensely obvious at first, but then it's mentioned that he owns that bar. And he then goes out. Now, what then follows is a pretty interesting set of circumstances where adventures come to him in the form of, like, missions, like, say, this woman's been killed or this lady's been killed, and she dies, and then she's a ghost, and there's something, like, it's like, you know, Crime of the Week kind of style, like almost like a murder mystery kind of thing or a private detective show. And you know, it builds the world around it, and the art's fantastic. Like, in the first issue, one of his mates comes along, and he's been converted into being a vampire, and he's got to then find the person who turned him into a vampire and kill him before he kills his friend as well. There's a very somber feel to a lot of the storylines. The art's fantastic. It's aged very well. The writing is atmospheric. It's kind of downbeat writing. Like, the guy's old, he's got this scar, he was a veteran of these demon wars that finished like 20 years ago. There's allegations at times that he's kind of coasting on his rep, but he's still a very established fighter. I really enjoyed it. It also plays around with a lot of books at the time, fantasy books, like if readers are familiar with Michael Moorcock, a British fantasy writer and sci-fi writer, he had a series of books called The Eternal Champion Cycle, which were a lot of his storylines were obsessed with the notion of this Eternal Champion going through different realities, and Tanalorn was one of his cities in one of the storylines, I believe it was Hawkmoon, and that gets referenced in the opening chapter where you come and meet Grimjack, and they've sort of got kind of got like an intro piece before they go into the storylines. From back in like the, it's from the early 80s through to the early 90s. I've read like a good 2/3 of the first omnibus and I'm kind of hooked. It's a heavy read. You've got to kind of pay a bit of attention. It's a meaty read, which I really enjoy. I couldn't help but compare it to Alien Legion, which I also read. I probably slightly prefer Alien Legion to Grimjack, but they're both very good. Like, if Alien Legion is like a 9 out of 10, like Chuck Dixon's run, this is a solid 8 to 8.5 out of 10. Like, this is a good read, and I'm going to keep reading. Like, I was quite invested, actually, to be honest. I found it was quite compelling, you know, like, rather than boring. I was kind of like kind of hooked, and the only reason I stopped reading was simply a time thing, like more than anything. I really think that this is some of the better comic books we've done on the show. The art, I want to bring up the art. The art by Timothy Truman it's dark, it's gritty, it's very based around the character. He's great visually. There's great action scenes. Look, I'm looking here. I'm at page 201 of 390, so that's how much I've read. And I will continue to read this, like, after this show. Like, I'm not going to abandon this omnibus. I feel like I'm invested. There's a lot going on. Now, one of the questions you might have is, like, how does this compare to, say, Astronium Dog, okay, to pick an example of a bounty hunter storyline. They're kind of probably a bit more action-packed. John Gaunt is a lead character. He's very solitary, almost embittered, cynical. That's the kind of storyline that you're dealing with here. I think it probably gets into... I'd be interested, like, in the Munden's Bar, I believe they did a lot of backup stories in the back of Grimjack, which involve characters like the Turtles coming in, like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles would come in the 80s to the bar. I think that's really cool. I was disappointed that the collection didn't include that because I think that would have given a different flavor as well. It was all like strong coffee. I call it strong coffee comics. Like, you felt like you were drinking black coffee. That's how I feel with Alien Legion too. I felt like it was like, there was a meat on the bones to these comic books back then. I think they were doing some really interesting things. I think it came out through First Comics and then later went to IDW. These are ones I'd like to get paperbacks for and have them on my shelf, or hardcovers and have them on my shelf. I think it's comic books are going to last the test of time, and I can understand why if you were collecting Grimjack back then, it would have been like people reading 2008 Johnny Alpha. Like, you would have just hooked it into your life. I'm coming in late in the piece and still picking up that this is a pretty heavy comic book that's being thrown down, I think radically ahead of its time. If you think that, like, for the mainstream comic book audience, Frank Miller sort of revolutionized everything with Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen, this was years before. And it tells you that there was darkness and there was maturity in comic books back then, in the early 80s. It just took some time for the indies to break through into the mainstream. John Ostrand, obviously a highly accomplished writer, had long runs on, for example, Spectre. Suicide Squad is probably his biggest, most famous run for most people. Did a lot of good Star Wars work. A very gifted writer. I like that this is his own project with Timothy Truman, and together they're so accomplished. And you feel like... I mean, I got a ton of this Grimjack stuff. I've got like two omnibuses to go through, and I'm hooked. I've reached out to get John Ostrander on the show. I'd like to run through it with him. I'd like to talk some stuff with him about this. The sky's the limit. If you're a reader of Grimjack, if you're a fan, look, reach out to The Signal, give us your thoughts. I'll happily read them next show. as I said, I'm going to give it 8.5 out of 10, I think. And I would say that it could even, it probably gets even better, I think. You know, like, I feel like when you start from the start, it's kind of like, you got to remember, if you start off at the start of Spider-Man, there's going to be like a pretty steep learning curve where you're going to have to be pretty resilient, or Batman, Superman. You know, it's different back in the day. This starts in the early 80s, and it actually feels like it's more late 80s. It felt like this was a good 5-6 years ahead of its time as a piece, and I mean that as a complete compliment. And it's backed by great art by Timothy Truman, and they're co-creators, so they must have collaborated quite heavily on this. Classic for a reason. Grimjack, John Gaunt, an embittered ex-mercenary working from a bar in a city that's the nexus of multiple realities. I mean, what a cool concept. It almost sounds like some stuff that's in the Des Moines series, really, frankly, and yet I'd never heard of it. I gets points for Roger Zelani, who wrote Chronicles of Amber, apparently in one of the Chronicles of Amber books. I haven't read it. John Gaunt's referenced. I like the fact that this was a character that permeated across other, you know, people's worlds, because that's very much the storyline here. Like, it's really open to the idea of it could land on Batman's reality, and Grimjack could have an adventure with Batman, for example. There's really no weaknesses to this book. It's just very strong. It's just very much of a – it's a very strong piece, unfiltered. You get the feeling like this was them, you know, really spinning their wheels and having fun in their own universe. Probably I would say that, like, these didn't have to be comic book approved. That's actually a question I have. Do they have to be comic code approved, these first comics? Like, let's, you know what? Like, fuck coming back next week to tell people. First comics, were they comic book code approved? Comic code approved. Let's see. I'm pretty sure that we won't get an answer here, but at least you're getting an insight into journalism 101. And we're hitting Google. A whole lot of shit about the comic code, but what we don't have is just stuff about first comics. So I will come back to you next week with some stuff on that, because I got the feeling that these were sort of not comic code approved. These felt like they were these felt like they were probably going sort of outside of the comic code, because they feature some heavy violence. There's some sexual themes. None of it's explicit, but you know, I just felt like this was darker and more interesting than DC and Marvel were around the same time, because they were so filtered back then, even in the early 80s. Like, first comics, okay, comic book publisher from 83 to 91, known for titles such as American Flag, Grimjack, Nexus, Badger, Dreadstar, and John Sable. Okay, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, there's nothing here about, like, the comic code. Here we go. Well, people say I don't do journalism. First took advantage of the growing direct market, attracting a number of writers from DC and Marvel to produce career-end titles, which, as they were not subject to the comics code, were free to feature more mature content. Well, there we go. I mean, sometimes I'm so happy with my journalism. Like, I'm hitting fucking Google, I'm going everywhere. Well, okay, so this proves my point. First comics, okay, and hey, look, American Flag, Grimjack, Nexus, and Badger, Dreadstar, and John Sable, all very highly established basically titles, high-end titles. Okay, so that explains why. That explains why Grimjack's a bit darker, because it's not that people back in the early 80s didn't have these kind of storylines in them. It's just inside of DC and Marvel they were more strict and didn't allow this kind of stuff, whereas here it comes on the page, and it's not hugely explicit. You know, they're not dropping F-bombs on every page, or indeed on any, but there's a bit more violence, there's a bit more sexual sort of, like, allusions and stuff. Like, yeah, it's, and it works. Like, it's, I think it's hugely appealing. Grimjack, 8.5 out of 10. I'd encourage you, if you like John Ostrander, you should definitely pick it up. If you like sort of that late 80s kind of vibe of comics, where there was a more, slightly more, it was kind of like late teen, early 20s, kind of into the 30s kind of feel. Like, everything's a little bit more sophisticated, a little... Like, these comics are quite dark, I find. Like, it often ends with sort of, like, Crime of the Week ends with Grimjack kind of walking in, making a sarcastic comment at the end. It's that kind of a style thing. Like a show like The Equalizer or something. It's sort of teaching morality through a fairly dark prism. I found it very appealing. So, look... I could say more, but I feel like I've given my hype for this. And, you know, next week we're going to have on Ray. We're going to do Walking Dead, the first 12 issues of Walking Dead. That's been decided, which covers the first volume of the hardcover. I know we did the first volume of Walking Dead, the first 6 issues, some time ago on the show, but I'm going to restart from the beginning. As you know, I've got 15 hardcovers now that I bought off Amazon, so that's funny. Look... It's been a big couple of days for me. As I said, I got engaged to Michelle, and that's a real pleasure for both of us. And, you know, thank you to listeners who've reached out already and congratulated us. So it's very much appreciated. We've been together a long time, and this was just the natural next step. Yeah, and look, Signal of Doom's on Facebook. We're on Twitter, at RedLantern2051 on Twitter. Look, support my books, Des Moines, Blade of Exile, Des Moines, City of Innocence, Des Moines Soulfighter are all available on Amazon through Kindle or paperback. Jump on board. You can jump on board Soulfighter on board book 3. It's a standalone. There's a glossary at the start to familiarize yourself. Look, just go for it. On that note, I'd like to thank you all. I'll catch you next week with Ray here. Keep it safe, kids. Keep it fluid. You know, keep moving. Stay alert. Stay aware. Keep killing if you have to. Most of all, stay alive. Okay, love you guys, bye.
Trader Vic's. His hair was perfect.